four, five, six, and there's an aeroplane overhead. See what happens. Try it, Chilly. Just say something, Count.
Well, my name is William Alexander Manfield.
This is a tape of, this is the heading. William Alexander Manfield, M-A-N-F-I-E-L-D. Underneath that, Commander. Underneath that, Royal Canadian Navy, spell it out, brackets, retired. Close the brackets. The text commences. This tape is made on 23rd of June 1982 in Sydney, British Columbia. Chilly, thank you for agreeing to have me out here this morning. And I think we'll start by you telling me when you joined the Navy and why, and we'll go on from there.
Well, I always had a hankering to go to sea from the time I was old enough to watch the merchant ships passing Bowen Island and Ballina Island, and my father used to take us there for our annual holidays. When HMS Curlew came to Vancouver in 1927...
Can you spell Curlew?
C-U-R-L-E-W.
Yep.
Came to Vancouver in 1927. They sent a detachment up to Chilliwack. It was tied up with the Chilliwack Cherry Festival, which my father was part of the organization. They marched past the famous Five Corners in Chilliwack, and I was smitten, as were four or five others from Chilliwack. The first one to join was Archie Conway, whose father was the engineer officer of the Agassiz Rosedale Ferry, but had been a Royal Navy Lieutenant Commander engineer from the lower deck, and was a very great friend of Captain Eric Brandt. After Archie had joined, I applied and was accepted, and I left Chilliwack on the 16th of September 1928, proceeded with my father to Vancouver and over to Victoria. Got the number 4 streetcar out to the dockyard, where my father reckoned the obvious place for the Navy to be, and we're told it was wrong, and to go back to Admiral's Road and walk downhill till we came to the Naval Barracks, which we did. My father inquired the name of the captain, who happened to be Commander Nellis, and this Sub-Lieutenant Reiter, the chap the name of Sub-Lieutenant Rupert Anthony Wright, later Paymaster Rear Admiral Wright. My father was introduced to Commander Nellis, and I was whisked away to do my in routine. Completed that just before noon, went back, and my father and Commander Nellis were still speaking. I said, I'm in. He said, well, it's about time I left. Shook hands. His only advice to me was, be careful of the girls. And off he went. And I was in the Navy for 7 years.
How old were you?
I was 17 years and 4 months at that time. Mm-hmm. Rate of pay was 50 cents a day, and they kept back $10 a month till you went on leave. And the you weren't allowed much leave in the Navy in those days. Boys seamen were allowed Saturday afternoons and Sundays from 1 o'clock till 9 o'clock. And you had to be turned in by 9:15. So you'd ask to get some money from the divisional petty officer, who would dole it out, 5 cents for an ice cream cone, 10 cents streetcar fare into town, 10 cents for a streetcar back, and 15 cents for the Columbia Pictures. That was the cheapest theater in Victoria at the time. Well, we made up for that, but we'd have two extra ice cream cones because we'd walk into Esquimalt, from Esquimalt into Victoria, go to the show, and walk back, invariably in time for 9 o'clock, Liberty Boating.
Yeah. No leave during the week?
No.
No.
If there were a making mend on a Wednesday, it was usually spent on the sports field, chasing each other around, learning the game of rugby, and Commander Nellis chasing us around, blowing his whistle, and giving us 1-2 for what we didn't know about rugger. And that was by boy seaman training time, plus, of course, the usual drills and so on and so forth.
What subjects did you take then?
Just general seamanship. I also wrote the educational test part one, which came up in September, and I passed it, which was a rarity because most of the lower deck chaps in those days could barely read or write, and I was one of about five who passed the course. So then the schoolmaster...
What grade were you in school before you joined then?
Oh, I'd failed grade 9 high school because I couldn't understand Parisian French and English.
Yes, I know.
So, anyway, having passed this, the schoolie said, you're now eligible for the higher educational test. Now, what would you like to take? As I'd learnt electricity back home, working with my father, I said, right, I'd like electricity and magnetism. No sweat, he could get a chief EA to teach me that. General knowledge, he'd be able to manage that. But navigational might prove a bit of a problem. However, the following day he came back and said, Manfield, I've solved the problem. I found a young lieutenant passing through who will teach you pilotage and navigation for the length of time he's here, which was roughly 1 month. And my instructor at that time was one Lieutenant brackets N, H.G. DeWolf. Needless to say, I passed a second class certificate for my navigation and pilotage, first class for general knowledge, and second class for electricity and magnetism. I then was promoted ordinary seaman on the 9th of May, 1929, and immediately drafted to HMCS Vancouver. The commanding officer being Lieutenant Commander Rupert Wayneman Wood, and the first lieutenant, Lieutenant W.B. Brackets Scarface Holmes,
yeah.
RCM.
Talk about Scarface Holmes.
Pardon?
What was he like?
He was a very strict disciplinarian, had very little sense of humor, if any. And you are always in the rattle, one way or the other. I managed to successfully dodge it for quite some time until I did get into it. 4 days number 11 for throwing four water bottles over the side. When at a short arm inspection, they cleared lower decks, and one of the stewards came out with his putter's boots, knocked over the water bottles, which I was cleaning at the pump, and I figured these were no good, and tossed a whole lot over the side, and was put in the rattle for destroying government property. I should have saved either the bottom or the neck of the bottle, I'm not sure which. So I got 4 days number 11 for that, and I finished up polishing the guardrails on the quarter day. And that was my first rattle aboard ship.
So now you have, you're a real OD, you have a crime sheet.
That's right.
That's right. What about your navigation instructor? How did you find him?
Oh, he was very good and very patient and understanding. And it wasn't until 1946 when our paths crossed again. Well, they crossed many times, but he was still a young lieutenant, and I was by this time a an able seaman, and we didn't have much in common because I was in the gunnery world and he was in doing his own thing. But I always remember Harry DeWolf suffered from seasickness, but I will say he always carried his bucket up to the bridge, tied it up the voice pipe in the corner, used it as necessary, and the completion of the watch, he took it down and rinsed it out himself. And I thought that was a damn good show. My job in the ship in the first 6 months was cabin hand, where I provided the running hot and cold to the officers' quarters and made up their bunks and things like this. And this is where I acquired the name of Chilliwack. I was down making up the gunner's bunk at the time, and I heard him say, "Who are you looking for, Sullivan?" And Sullivan was sometimes a three badge or no badge AB, depending on conditions. And he said, "I was looking for ordinary seaman, the ordinary seaman from Chilliwack." And I said, "That's me, sir." And so I went out and I said, "What do you want, Sullivan?" And he said, "You've got some Enos fruit salts." I said, "I got a hangover." I said, "Yeah, you can take it," and told him what my locker was. And from then on, I was referred to as Chilliwack. And over the years, it became shortened to Chilli, and that's how I acquired my nickname.
I noticed you used the term, you were a, quote, cabin hand, unquote. Now, in the Royal Navy, they were always referred to as officer servants.
Well, that's true. We were officer servants.
Was that term used then in the Royal Canadian Navy?
Yes, very much so.
Because much later on, we changed it to cabin hand because we found that term odious to Canadian seamen.
Yeah, well, it was odious to me at the time. I didn't like it, but you had to go along with it, and I preferred the latter term, and that's why...
That's why you used it.
Yeah. And,
so there you are, an ordinary seaman in Vancouver, yeah.
My other chief claim to fame as far as the gunner was concerned, and I don't know whether you should tape this or not.
Oh, we can take it out if you don't want it.
Well, he's long since dead, but this morning we're going from A jetty over to floating dock, and I was told to call the officers and take down their running hot and cold, which I did, and the officers were Lieutenant Holmes, Sub-Lieutenant Tisdall, and Mr. Sieber. I called them all and went on about my duties of peeling the spuds because I was a veg cook in the mess because I was never available for washing dishes at the right time with all doing other jobs at the offices. And the next thing was ordinary seaman Manfield report to the bridge. So up I went and Lieutenant Holmes was standing on top of the wheelhouse, a little flat wheelhouse we had, and he said, "Where's Mr. Seabrook?" And I said, "I called him, sir." He said, "Well, tell him to get up here immediately." And I said, "Yes, sir." So I went down below and Mr. Seabrook was still pounding his ear. I said, "Mr. Seabrook, sir, the first time I want you on the bridge." He said, "Pound well, whoa, whoa." I said, "Mr. Seabrook, sir." He repeated the message. So I was at a loss. I went up and I saw the engineer's writer, Sam Haig, who was the writer for Lieutenant Davies, the engineer officer at the time. I said, "Sam," I called the gunner and he told me to tell the first lieutenant what to do. He said, "You're always supposed to obey the orders of an officer. Go up to the bridge and tell him." Being as green as grass, I did. And I stood up on the back end of the bridge, chopped off a salute to the first lieutenant. I said, "Mr. Seabrook says, go F yourself." And Rupert Wayman Wood was pacing up and down the bottom and looked with a quizzical eye at me and grinned and looked up at the first lieutenant and wondered what he's going to do next. By the time the first lieutenant came down from being 10 feet high, he said, "Get Mr. Seabrook up here immediately." "Aye, sir." I went to the back of the bridge and I saw Mr. Seabrook on the quarterdeck with his oilskins over his pajamas, taking charge of the situation. So I turned around and reported, "Mr. Seabrook's on the quarterdeck. I carry on what you don't." Which I did. But an hour later, after we'd secured at the floating dock, Army Seaman Manfield lay aft. I went aft, Mr. Seabrook, impeccably dressed. Coxswain said, Ordinary Seaman Manfield, off cap. And Mr. Seabrook said, no, Coxswain, he's not in the rattle. He can put his cap back on. Ordinary Seaman Manfield, on caps. If you can carry on, Coxswain. The coxswain went up forward, shaking his head. The gunner said, Manfield, I'd like to have a talk with you. Come with me. We went down between the two depth charge rails. And he said, have you ever learnt the meaning of the word tact and diplomacy? And I said, well, yes, sir. He said, do you think you're very tactful this morning? And I started to explain, and then he interrupted, and he started to give me a lecture, and if I hadn't gone stand easy, I would have been there yet. I learned tact and diplomacy very quickly.
That's good. Who was captain of Vancouver? I missed it.
Rupert Wainman Wood.
Oh, he was the...
The lieutenant commander.
Oh,
and his son was in the Navy later on. Mm-hmm. Captain Wainman Wood turned over to ordnance mm-hmm. and became probably our first ordnance captain in the Navy.
So, there you're... You missed the rattle that time.
Yes. And... then I stayed in Vancouver till 1930, and I drafted overseas to commission the new Skeena and to qualify Seaman Gunner at Whaley. We spent the first 6 months on board HMS Warspite. That was 1930, 29 and part of 30, and then I went to Whaley and qualified Seaman Gunner and drafted to Skeena for her commissioning under V.G. Badur and Francis Houghton as the XO.
Yeah. Badur was a commander, was he?
He was a commander at the time.
Yeah. How did you find him?
Very good, except when we're carrying out a shoot, I was a trainer of X-Gun, and of course at Whaley you'd been always taught to follow the pointers, but you were always assumed to be on A or B gun, because nobody ever told you about that little pointer down at the bottom, pointed 180 degrees on X and Y guns, so when the big pointer started to go one way and the little pointer went the other, I debated and followed the wrong one. My gun was trained to starboard and everybody else to port. They fired on the up roll, I fired on the down roll. Next thing was, the voice from the bridge said, who's that trainer on hex gun? He won't be a Seaman gunner long. I wasn't. I left shortly afterwards to go to Whaley for gunner second class.
What was life like in the mess deck in those days? The general spirit of the troops and what we refer to as morale, I suppose.
Morale was good. You had your own sense of discipline in the mess decks. Usual fist fights, those who were strongest ran the show, but the leading hands were very good.
Yeah.
So were the petty officers, they had understanding. With a great degree of lack of understanding between officers and lower deck.
Yeah.
They were strictly this caste system, a sailor with a sailor and a officer with an officer.
Yeah. Even
when we went to the West Indies, the ratings were not allowed on the white man's beach. They were allowed to swim with the Negroes, or the natives, and the officers were allowed to swim on what we referred to the white man's beaches, that was the rich or the well-to-do, had part of the beach reserved for them. And this was one of the little things which got my back up, and probably quite a few others.
Yeah, well, Admiral Budge told me once, many years ago, he said, in Bermuda, when he was a rating, there were signs on some bars and that it said, dogs and sailors not allowed. He said,
And that was very true in San Diego National Park as well. A sign on the gate said sailors and dogs not allowed.
So you got first billing there anyway. You were head of dogs.
We were head of dogs there.
Yes. Well, that covers sort of that aspect of the officer man relationship in the, but it was good. They were good officers, nevertheless.
Oh, definitely, yeah. Definitely. Those that were good were very, very good. Mm-hmm. And of course, we had the usual people who just wouldn't have fitted into any system, either from the lower deck or the officers section. Neither of them should have been in the service, you know. In my way of thinking.
Yeah, well, I know the time. I know the type. Did you have your eyes on a commission back then?
No. I had a reason for wanting to go to England for courses all the time, because I met a young lady in Scotland, and this caused me to, every time there was an opportunity for a course, off I went to Willie, and also an opportunity to go up to Scotland to see her, and this went on until 1939, when we got married, and that was only reason I went through for warrant officer, really, was I reached the top of the tree as a petty officer gunner's mate,
yeah,
in 1936. I said, now how can I get back? And the only way was to go through for WOW, so I did. And I guess...
I think I know that lady.
You should.
That's Doe.
That's right.
That's Doe, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, many other people tell similar stories.
Yeah.
There are a half a dozen other tapes.
Yeah.
So, anyway, what are you now? I've forgotten. You're still a...
Well, I went...
You're in Skeena? No.
I was in Skeena as an ordinary seaman.
Seaman.
Then as a naval seaman. When I went to Warspite, I was still an ordinary... Sorry, I was an ordinary seaman when I went to Warspite. I put in to be made able seaman at 15 months, and they said no, although I'd been recommended in Canada for that. So when it came 18 months, I said, right, it wouldn't make me at 15 months, I'm not going to be made at 18 months, so I'd be independent as well. And so I did not put in a request until ordered to do so, which I then did. And I found out the reason for ordering me to become an able seaman that day, they were short of shore patrol, and I got promoted AB and was made one of the shore patrol in Weymouth in southern England, and that was my first experience in the Navy. I found I couldn't beat the system, better go along with it. And
why did you go to Warspite from Skeena?
For sea training in the RN.
Mm-hmm.
And then I went to Whaley to qualify. After I got made AB, went to Whaley to qualify seaman gunner in time to do that and commission the Skeena.
Oh, this is before the commissioning of Skeena.
Yeah.
I got you. Yeah. Okay. So you're back in Skeena.
And I stayed in Skeena till 34 when I went over again to the RN. went to Whaley and qualified as gunner second class, and then was drafted to Hood.
Put HMS Hood in there.
Yes, HMS Hood, and I became captain of the Port Multiple Pompon, which was a fairly new gun, referred to as the Chicago Piano,
which yes,
was an 8-barrel pompon. I found out at the same time that Midshipman Dyer was on board.
Ken Dyer.
Ken Dyer. And years later he said, Bill, he said, you know, he said, you were senior to me when we were in Hood. I said, yes, but I didn't look on it that way. You had the potential. I
yes.
Still had a long way to go. And we had quite a chuckle about that.
Yes, of course. Do you remember much about Dyer in those days?
Dyer?
Dyer, yeah. Ken Dyer?
No, because we were just passing. Yeah. We were only together for the 2 weeks.
Yeah. Were there any other Canadian midshipmen on board?
Not to my knowledge.
No.
Then I left Hood and came back to Esquimalt and went to the Vancouver. as a leading seaman, gunner second class. And I stayed in her until I was promoted acting petty officer, and then again drafted overseas in 36 to qualify gunner's mate. I completed my courses in Whaley, and then commissioned Fraser as a gunner's mate of Fraser, and brought her around to the West Coast.
Who was captain?
Wallace Creery.
Yes.
And Pat Tisdall was the first lieutenant and gunnery officer, my sub-lieutenant from Vancouver days.
Yes.
And I stayed in her, Fraser, until August 39, when I was scheduled to catch the Empress of Australia in Quebec City on the 1st of September to go over to Whaley for my gunner's course. I appeared, but the Empress of Australia didn't. So I inquired the local reserve division, and they phoned all the ones that send him down to Halifax and we'll get him over someday, some way. And so I went down and slept on board Fraser, because the accommodation in the barracks was terrible at that time. And so I spent all the time waiting for the Lancastria, which I finally did passage in, along with one Lieutenant Hibbard.
J.C. Hibbard.
J.C. Hibbard, W.W. Porteous. There was seven of us. Two RCN midshipmen going back, or sub-lieutenants going back for their courses. One was Izard, and the other was Forrest.
Izard, I-Z-A-R-D?
Yes, who I believe got out shortly afterward. Forrest stayed in and became a Commander E. And the lower deckers were myself, Harry McClymont, who became a lieutenant commander and tied up very much with the Benevolent Fund, and a chap by the name of Radio Briggs. He was a WT operator. And so the captain asked us if we, having nothing else to do except keep our afternoon watch as lookout, because the Geneva Convention still applied, would we listen to the radio and put out a newspaper for the troops? So we listened in on the various radios, interpreted the Polish spelling of what Germany had captured and so on, and put out this news bulletin, which the captain thought was great, and so did the ship's company, because they didn't have a chance to read the radio. And so we worked our way across the Atlantic and arrived in the Thames on October the 10th. 39, I went off to Whaley to start my boat course.
So that was the last you saw of Fraser?
Yeah.
With Creery in command?
Yeah.
And
Tisdall at that time.
Tisdall XO?
Yeah. But now, I don't know when she was sunk, if Tisdall was still on board or not. But Creery, I know what.
Yeah.
And Blair McLean, who was a surgeon, I'd known him when he was a young seaman torpedoman out of the Edmund and Half Company. And he used to come down and do our southern cruises with us. And we learned that he had knew a bit about female anatomy, because he being a pre-med student, and he would tell us things that we should have known and didn't know.
Oh,
and,
well.
The most interesting.
Yes, very interesting. How old were you?
18.
Oh, yeah, very interesting.
Yeah.
18. So you've left, you arrived in the UK and left Fraser.
Yeah, and I stayed in the UK till April. I volunteered to stay on in the RN. The reason being my wife was still there, and I was in there, and I figured I'd give it a couple of more years before we got separated. However, I was told one morning to report the LOI, and he said, come on, Yankees, you're leaving for Canada this afternoon. And I said, what about my wife? He said, well, we'll send her later. And I said, no, I'd rather she come with me if it's possible. He said, well, if you can get her up to London this afternoon, get her passport and things, I'll arrange it by phone. And you get in touch with her. And I said, well, that's difficult. I said, I'll go and pack. I said, she always phones me at 12 o'clock. And so when she phoned at 12, I said, rush home and pack your bags. We're catching a 1:24 train for London. She said, I can't. I just sent all your shirts to laundry. I said, never mind. You get home and pack. I said, if you can get the shirts back, so much the better. In the meantime, I arrived before she did. I opened up the chest of drawers, dumped everything into the trunk, which was all the things that we possessed that I didn't have in my trunk. The wedding presents were still wrapped in the basement. Left a note for the landlady who'd gone off to see her brother in Bath, and said, I would arrange for, when I got to London, for Thomas Cook to come and pick up the parcels that I left £2 on there for rent. So we went up to London, took my wife over to Canada House, from where she was to be processed for entering Canada.
Yes.
I said, I'll go back to Waterloo Station and you stay there till I get back. So I went back to Waterloo Station, arranged with Thomas Cook and Sons, and they were going to pick the Christmas present, the wedding presents up and send them over in due course. And my address would be HMCS Stadacona, that's all I knew.
Yes.
And so I was on decided to head back over to Charing Cross. And I was going down the escalator on the Waterloo Station, and I saw my wife coming up the other side, and I yelled, stop when you get to the top.